From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
Pay no attention to that man. We will not be taking your phone calls today. We're coming to you live from the Legata Summit 2025 edition in beautiful Naples, Florida, where it is sunny and 78 degrees for all of those of you that are battling the ice storm in the upper Midwest. I hate to rub it in, but it's absolutely gorgeous here. So we won't be taking your calls today. We're going to give you a little feel of the Legata Summit as we did yesterday. And in our first segment, we're pleased to be joined by our chairman and chief executive officer, Mr. Michael Warsaw, who is always so gracious at these events to take, you know, I spend half of my event answering the question, is Michael here? These are not always relaxing events for you, are they?
No, but they're great events, and it's great to be with you to be able to do this show, but and to take a few minutes to actually sit down, which is a nice thing. But they're great events, and you know, I mean, I've been a part of Legata for at least 15 years now, and coming to the summits, you know, every year. You know, when we talk about the EWTN family, well, there's kind of a Legata family too, and you begin to, you know people from around the country. And I also do a lot of speaking at Legata chapters as well, so it's always a nice time to, you know, come and reconnect with people maybe that I met somewhere in giving a talk or something at a Legata chapter somewhere in the country. And they're just great. They're great events to be together. Also the prayer, the liturgy, you know, the whole aspect of the formation. They're just a great event, and it's good to be here. And it's good to have EWTN be a part of this. We're a very prominent part of this event, and that's always good to see. One of the things we do is, of course, we give out EWTN hats. They're here at our booth,
and lunch is outside,
so it's a very, very practical thing, and you know, so you can see everybody wearing their EWTN hats, you know, across the room and across the lawn there. So yeah, so it's been a great relationship between Legata and EWTN over the years, going back to Mother Angelica and Tom Monahan, who of course is the founder of Legata. It's an important apostolate that Tom began many, many years ago, and certainly had a relationship with Mother, and even, as you know, Tom was also the founder of Domino's Pizza, and there's that iconic footage that you'll see sometimes still on the network of Mother Angelica and Tom Monahan, you know, making pizza in the studio. Yeah. So anyway, it's just wonderful to be here, and wonderful also to bring our EWTN radio family here in a way through our coverage and our live broadcasts from here.
You know, it's our Lord told us to go and preach the gospel to everybody, and I think especially in our busy, affluent culture in the West and in the United States, you know, we lose sight of the fact that the gospel is for everyone. And you know, this is targeting a group, Catholic business leaders, that I think most people would not be the first group of people that people would say need to be evangelized,
right,
or need to be catechized or need to be built up. But it's an important group because the trickle down from this group is unlimited.
Absolutely. No, it's huge. It's huge. And you're right. It is an important group. And, you know, when you think and you look across the room, I mean, Legata is an organization of Catholic CEOs and business owners, you know, who employ collectively tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people. And the principles that CEOs enact within their business, within their companies, the way in which they live out their faith and witness to their faith, to their employees, to their employee families, all of that is so, so critical. And it's building that Catholic Christian culture within companies. Is just reaches so, so many people beyond, you know, just the few hundred that are here. But it just reinforces the idea that, you know, this is an important group that needs formation, that needs support. And that's one of the things I think that's really wonderful when you come is, you know, this connection that you have with other people who are leaders in the business space and you know, being able to share experiences or share stories, share ways of supporting one another. You know, I'm very blessed because obviously EWTN is a fully 100%, you know, unabashedly Catholic organization, you know, founded by a nun and dedicated to the advancement of truth as defined by the church. You know, we're as Catholic as you can get. If you're in a secular business environment, particularly in this moment, particularly over these last many years with so many of the challenges that the government, that the threats to religious liberty, all of these things that have really impacted businesses and particularly Christian and Catholic business owners, coming to an event like this and being able to be with your peers and talk through some of the challenges is really, really, really important, you know, and, you know, the multiplier effect in a way of what comes out of this is just tremendous. So it's a very important community. It's a very important event to be a part of.
Talking with Michael Warsaw, the Chief Executive Officer and Chairman of the Board of EWTN, here at the 2025 Legatus Summit in Naples, Florida. You know, one of Mother Angelica's legacies is that she always gave a voice to those who were about a good work in the church. And this is one of the perfect examples of that.
Right. Right.
What we're doing right now.
Right. No, that actually, if you read the full mission statement of EWTN that was written by Mother Angelica in 1980 when she founded EWTN, there's a section of that mission statement which talks about the network being available to apostolates and to people and missions with ministries within the church. Who were aligned with the church and the church's teaching and being a platform for those good works that are going on so that they can be amplified so that people can become aware of the great things that are happening in the church. And so this is exactly to that point that Mother Angelica was thinking of back all those many years ago, almost 45 years ago now.
You know, we've talked many times about what we think Mother Angelica would think of where things have gone if she were here to offer her opinion. I'll throw the question back on you. When you were the director of on-air promotions at EWTN, could you have imagined, one, that you would be in the position that you're in now, or two, compare EWTN then to what you're sitting on top of now?
Yeah, so to the first question, could I have imagined it? Absolutely not. You know, I think even back to before I came to work for EWTN in 1991, several years prior to that, I came to Irondale and met with Mother and putting some projects together. And I remember sitting in that chair in her office, and we were talking for quite a while and getting to know one another. You know, and if you had asked me at that point, you know, well, you know, do you think you'll ever, you know, be at EWTN, let alone, you know, succeeding Mother, I would have just laughed at you, you know, and thought, well, you know, God obviously had other plans. So no, I don't think, you know, I don't think I could have ever envisioned that. And in some ways, I remember asking Mother one time, she and I were walking in Hansville at the new monastery, and I said, did you ever think that this would be what it is, and she said, you know, no, sweetheart, I never ever thought that it would become what it's become. I was too busy worrying about getting through, you know, day to day, to worry about what the future would hold, you know, and that trust in Providence in that moment. So yeah, it's incredible to look back at that and all of those years now and to see where EWTN has come from those beginnings in the garage in Irondale, Alabama, with Mother and the nuns and the sheep and the goats, and you know, it's just an
couple of those
story.
Couple of those goats are still around.
Probably,
they were,
yeah.
They were helping to build that garage.
I don't know that they'd appreciate being called the goats. I was talking about literal four-legged goats, but if you want to call some of your coworkers goats, well, okay.
Throw me under the bus. That's,
yeah,
that's,
Jody Copeland might have some words
really
with
where
you
I was,
there.
You know,
so yes,
I've called Jody worse, so I'm sure he'll be okay with GOAT.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, Jody Copeland was actually the first employee of EWTN.
I call him number one.
Hired by mother, and he's still a member of the EWTN employee family all these years later, and has great stories, you know, to share with a lot of the younger employees about what. You know, what it was like in those early days with mother. So,
yeah. Well, Michael, thanks so much for taking time out, as you always do, to join us here, and enjoy the rest of the summit.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thanks, Jack. It's a great event, and glad to be here with you.
Awesome. That's Michael Warsaw, our chairman and chief executive officer here at the 2025 Legata Summit in Naples, Florida. It's EWTN's Open Line Friday.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
And once again, pay no attention to that man. We won't be taking your phone calls today. We're coming to you live from the 2025 Legatus Summit in Naples, Florida. And every year when this event is put on by the great organization here, Legatus, they bring somebody in to MC the entire event. This is the biggest one they've ever had. 650 legates from around the country and even beyond the borders of the country joining for this great summit. And they have chosen an EWTN mainstay, international correspondent Colm Flynn, not Flynn Rider from the movies, but Colm Flynn, to host this. And we were chatting before, Colm, and you're not from around here.
That's right, Jack. And by the way, they brought me in because I think they were badly stuck and nobody else was available. So the backup person they wanted, even he wasn't available. So I got the call and here I am. But you're right, I'm from Ireland. I'm from County Clare on the west coast of the Emerald Isle. And so we've been getting a kick out of that because I've been talking about it on the stage, about my Irish roots and the good things about being Irish, the not so good things, the funny things. And of course, everybody here is Irish, Jack.
So you're an Irishman living in Rome, working for an American company.
That's it. And I just married a lady from El Salvador to make it even more international. So
there you go. Yeah,
isn't it great?
Yeah. So how do we understand this this momentary lapse of judgment that this young lady has had?
I get no respect here. No respect. But you're right. People, when they see us, you know, when you hear for the first time punching above your weight, you go, oh, that's a funny joke. When I heard it for about the 50th time, I was like, there's something to this, I think. Yeah, it's like Beauty and the Beast. When people see it, they're like, what's going on here, you know? Yeah. But I don't know. She'd have to explain it. But she's stuck with me now.
So how would you describe what you do as international correspondent for EWTN News?
You know, when someone does very little in a company, it's always...
Michael Warsaw asked me to ask you that.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Michael Warsaw is over my shoulder now, my boss, so I'm like sweating a bit here at the moment. But, well, it started off as the Vatican correspondent, where I was brought in to cover the Holy See and the Holy Father, and just cover the day-to-day happenings at the Vatican, and, you know, never a dull moment at the Vatican, as we know. But that evolved, and we started covering more stories around the world. We started to go with the Holy Father, not just on his papal trips, but we would go before him. So if he was going to, like, for example, 2 years ago when he went to Mongolia, so we would go for EWTN News in Depth, and we would make a report, why is the Pope coming to Mongolia? Are there Catholics in Mongolia? What's he going to do when he's here? Because when the Pope is there on the ground, he's so busy. and there's, you know, crowds. It's very hard to get interviews and to get people to sit down and talk to you. So we thought, well, if we go beforehand, we can sit with the cardinals and the bishops and the ordinary people, and it's a nice complimentary piece for the actual papal visit. So we started doing that. It turned into be a winning formula because people were watching in big numbers on TV, but also online. And so we've been all over the world. This last year, Papua New Guinea, East Timor, Singapore, Indonesia, wherever the Pope goes. And so now we just cover stories, you know, not just covering the Pope, but the reopening of Notre Dame Cathedral. For Christmas, we went up to Norway, did the most northern cathedral in the world, in the Arctic Circle. We went to Canada to interview the Petersons about Tammy Peterson's miraculous recovery from cancer, her devotion to the rosary. So
she'll be here at this event later.
Yeah, she's speaking tomorrow, I believe it is. So I don't know, Jack, sometimes I think they're trying to get rid of me because they keep pushing me out the door. And they're like, here's a one-way ticket to South Sudan. And I said, but Mr. Warsaw, this is a one-way ticket. He said, don't worry about it. You know, we'll see when you get there. So but, it's great. It's a great blessing to be able to tell these stories around the world.
Yeah. Now, I'm guessing that you fancy yourself a bit of a storyteller. Or at least I hope you do, because that's what comes out in your reporting. And, you know, how does that play into how you approach these stories that are technically news stories, but really you make them into more than that?
Yeah, I'm not a very talented, nor am I a very smart guy. I don't have a great radio voice like you, Jack. You know, I don't have the looks really for to have a TV show or something. But what I think I am good at is connecting with people, sitting down with people and making them feel comfortable enough to open up and share their story. And you're right. I just came back from Miami. I was there a few days ago. We were doing a story on Judge Frank Caprio. He's this well-known judge in the United States on social media, but on television as well, because he shows such acts of kindness and compassion. But he's 88 now. He's retired. But he was a judge for 40 years in Rhode Island and in Providence, Rhode Island. So sitting down with him, what I hope I'm good at is, you know, okay, how do I make the light shine as brightly as it can on this man? He has had an illustrious career. He says, helped by his Catholic faith and his belief in God. He's struggling now with a cancer diagnosis, but praying to Jesus and asking other people for the prayers. So we have a camera crew with us. We will have editors. And my job is, how do we put all these pieces of the jigsaw together? The interview he has, the archive clips from his courtroom, the pictures from his past. How do I put that into 10 minutes to share with our audience and to keep people watching? You know, there's so much competition now, right, for eyeballs. How do I keep people watching from the start to the finish and to do him justice, to do a good piece for EWTN and ultimately serve the audience as well? Leave them something that will leave them uplifted.
I mean, in this age of social media,
it's tough.
Two-minute videos are too long, they'll tell you.
Yeah, and so that's what we're always fighting against. And I think you can go longer. You know, content is king, I always say, and the platform is queen. Because some people will say, well, it's too long for that platform. But if the content is there and it's, you know, look at podcasts. People will listen to podcasts for hours on end if they're really with the story. So, but the challenge for us then is, well, if you're going to stretch it and make it longer, you've got to make it really good. And you've got to make it really engaging. And that takes, you know, like you making radio, it takes a lot of work if you want to make it sound or look good.
So, apart from the storytelling aspect of things, journalism, especially in our culture here in the West, is not something that I think you could even call journalism by standards of not that terribly long ago, quite frankly. Do you take into account the state of journalism in our society when you approach these things? And what's your background and how is your journalistic instinct developed over the years?
Yeah, it's pretty disappointing for the United States, which, as you said, not that long ago, you had, you know, great kind of in-depth, fair, more balanced shows.
Walter Cronkite was the most trusted man in America, for crying out loud.
Yeah, the face and the voice of the news. Charlie Rose doing his, you know, one-hour discussion around a table where you could really get into something and debate an issue, talk about a story. Whereas now the problem is that, you know, we talked about it on social media. Everything is so soundbitey and short. But that's translating over to television. I mean, I was watching the Today Show this morning on NBC when I was in the gym, and every story is like just 90 seconds. And these are complicated stories, you know, with different sides, with different opinions, with different nuances. But they're trying too hard to squeeze as much in because they're competing with the other network. So they're trying to go snappier and faster. And then the bias, we do not have that as much in Europe, I don't think. Of course, we do have, you know, media that lean one way, media that leans another way. But what we have, because a lot of our media is publicly funded, like in Ireland, the public broadcaster RTE is paid for by the taxpayer. The BBC is paid for by the taxpayer in the United Kingdom. So they also have independent watchdogs who will try and keep an eye on things. And if you do feel that something was completely unfair, you can write to them and they will get broadcasters to issue corrections and apologies. So that kind of keeps things in check a bit. There are still our biases, of course. But in the United States, it seems, I think it was good for business for a while for networks to pick a side. It drove ratings. It was kind of, I think it became the new rock and roll, you know, political discourse. And you had to go hard on one side or the other. And that's fine for commentators to do that. But then the problem is then when networks, you know, and then people lose the trust. You look at networks, you know, like MSNBC and CNN, the ratings are at all-time lows. People see through that now and they want honesty, and that's why, you know, people are going back to things like radio and podcasting. Like with the discussion we're having now, if this was on television, it would most likely not be live. It would be recorded, it would be edited and chopped up, and you'd be at the mercy of a producer to think, well, I'll put this thing that Cullum said first and Jack's comment I'll put there, and you can change the whole tone, you can change the whole meaning. So with things like podcasting and long format, people can really get an idea of what someone's about and what they stand for, like Trump on the Joe Rogan podcast and J.D. Vance. I think, you know, with the younger demographic, that really helped to get them over the line to help him win the election.
Yeah, I think it's cute how you think I won't chop this up later and make it.
He's like, this guy is so boring, how do I chop this guy up and make him interesting? Thank you, Jack, for your vote of confidence.
So, listen,
get out of here. You're about
this
to
is
say.
Something we have not. This is something that we have not talked about. But
you're fired.
One of the most uplifting and inspirational things in our culture and in our society, for myself personally, and I know for other people as well, especially those of us under the umbrella of Holy Mother Church. There's nothing more uplifting than seeing a courtship and a marriage that is done with the right priorities. So to sort of follow, you know, via employee email a little bit,
yes,
your courtship and your wedding, it's, you know, and I can think back just to people in Birmingham where EWTN is located, young couples that have gone through formation, that have insisted on having a mass, and
yeah,
was, you know, done it the right. There is nothing more uplifting and edifying than that. Talk to our listeners here in just the minute and a half we have left, yeah, a little bit about
tell us this profound story in 25 seconds.
That's right, that's right.
No, but you're absolutely right. And I got married a month ago to the beautiful Paola Arriaza, who's now Paola Arriaza Flynn. She's from El Salvador, and she's also a reporter with EWTN. You know, that could have been a HR complaint, but it turned out to be a beautiful wedding. But you're so right. It's not rocket science, Jack, you know? And even at our wedding in Ennis, I got married in my hometown of Ennis in Ireland. I had many people there who, you know, are kind of lapsed Catholic, people who've fallen away from the faith. But I do some work every year with Estonian television. Now, Estonia, a small country on the Baltic Sea in Europe, it's known as the least religious country in Europe. So four people came to my wedding from Estonian TV. Now, they had no experience with Catholicism, even much with Christianity. They were moved during the sermon. And it was my uncle, Father James Flynn, who was a missionary in Angola for 30 years. He just did a beautiful mass with a great sermon. We had the bishop there. We had a number of other priests. We just concentrated on the beauty. I was close to tears the entire way through. And our formation as well. We got a great priest from the Dicastery of Divine Worship in Rome, because we're both based in Rome, to do the marriage prep. It was a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I don't know why you would do anything other. It's just, what a sacrament. I'm feeling the graces every single day.
Cullum, thanks for the time, and best of luck the remainder of the summit.
Jack, thank you so much for having me on.
Again, this is EWTN's Open Line, Friday live from the Legatus Summit 2025 in beautiful Naples, Florida.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Once again, we're coming to you live from the 2025 Legatus Summit in beautiful Naples, Florida. Pleased to be joined by the president of Students for Life, the ever-shrinking Kristen Hawkins. How are you?
Hi, how are you, Jack?
I am fantastic. Thank you very much. You know, we've had some great things happen since you and I spoke at this event last year. But this is no time to rest on our laurels, and we need to continue to move forward. And the last time I looked, abortions were still being performed, and attitudes amongst a lot of people had not changed. What is your focus now, and how do you see things since the election?
Yeah, I mean, tragically, the abortion numbers are about the same as they were before Roe's reversal. We had a lot of states, about 15 states, act courageously after Roe's reversal. We're going to see, hopefully, South Carolina, if they listen to me, ban all abortions by the end of this year. But you know, we still have abortions being committed. We don't have a national abortion reporting law, so it's always hard to know exactly how many abortions are being committed. But because of states like New York and Colorado and California, chemical abortion drugs are flowing into our states. Even if you live in a red state and you think, oh, we're safe, you know, I live in Florida or I live in Idaho or Wyoming that doesn't have legal abortion, or Texas, abortions are still happening in your state. And so when we're thinking about the global landscape and what we've got to do in the pro-life movement, not only do we have to continue to build up this army, right? Social movements rise and fall on their grassroots, which is what I'm obsessed with. That's what I do every day, is building this grassroots army that then goes and serves in all the various niches within the pro-life movement, whether it's service or politics or, you know, in a community aspect. But we also have to really target and stop the proliferation of chemical abortion pills, which are the leading cause of infant death, over 60, maybe 70% of abortions.
Not just infant death.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, women are dying, and we also know these pills are actually polluting our drinking water. The anti-progesterone metabolites that are in chemical abortions, because women are having abortions in their toilet bowls, they are flooding our and polluting our drinking water, and the FDA has allowed this for 25 years. We've also got to defund Planned Parenthood. I mean, President Trump has said he believes abortion to be now a mere states issue. Everybody in the pro-life movement deeply disagrees. Human rights should not begin or end at state lines. But if President Trump is serious about withdrawing the federal government out of abortion, he has to defund Planned Parenthood. We fund the nation's largest abortion vendor with more than $700 million of our tax dollars every year. They commit 392,000 abortions. They are the leading force in these state ballot referendums, funding political enemies of President Trump. He's got to defund them.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question. When you're on college campuses and you're dealing with these students, I know there's a certain amount of education that has to be done so that they have the tools that they need to go into the battle. How much, or is there any sort of part of what you do to just embolden these people to stand up against the current of the culture?
Yeah, I mean, that's my day-to-day job, right? Of going to the college campuses, high schools, finding young people who kind of know in their gut, in their mind, abortion's wrong, but don't know what to do about it. And that's what we do at Students for Life. We train them. We tell them, this is how you can make a difference. Here's how you can change your mind. Here's how you can serve a pregnant woman or a couple in crisis on your campus so they know they don't have to choose between their education and the life of their child. And that's what our 1,500-plus Students for Life groups do every single day on college and high school campuses across the country. And then we mobilize them at the state capitals. Then we mobilize them in Washington, D.C. And then we involve them in the broader, you know, political fights that we face. But day to day, what we're doing is changing the culture one conversation at a time, one young student who's being targeted by the abortion industry at a time.
Another thing I wanted to talk to you about, obviously, you know, every abortion is a tragic situation. You know, a life is lost every time, you know, a successful abortion takes place. A woman, whether she realizes it in the in the moment or not, which I think in the moment most of them do realize, that they're changed forever. And this is something that they're going to have to deal with for the rest of their lives. But what we don't hear a ton about, we hear some, but not a ton about, is, you know, there's a dude involved here.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and a lot of times we have this stereotypical impression of the dude involved in this situation is just the guy that skates off and has no responsibility. There are guys out there that care.
That's right.
Whose hands are tied.
Yeah. They have no legal rights. And I think it's sad. You think the young people, the young men I meet, you know, they've been told by their moms that if the girlfriend gets pregnant, you have to say it's your body, your choice. Even though they want her to choose life, that's what they have to say. That's in order to be a good guy, a supportive man, right? A pro-feminist man. And so you have these men who are wanting her to choose life. They say that phrase, it's your body, your choice, to her. And what she hears is go have an abortion. If a woman in crisis hears that phrase, your body, your choice, that tells her, the signal to her is have the abortion. And so I've met couples where the girls didn't want to have the abortion. She wanted him to stand up and say, I'll help you. He didn't want her to have an abortion, but he was told what to say. And then they went through with the abortion when neither one wanted to kill their child. And it's heartbreaking to hear some of these conversations. And so, you know, we have a young men's fellowship at Students for Life where we're encouraging these young men to not only join the pro-life movement, but become leaders in the movement, because they have this unique voice that they can speak to their peers in a way I can't reach. But they can speak to their peers and tell them to have courage and to rebuff that status quo, to say, no, you don't have to do this. I'll support you. I'll stand by with you. What do you need? I've even had young men who've, you know, said, if you have the baby, I will take sole custody. You never have to do anything ever again. Just please don't kill my child. And it's heartbreaking to have some of these conversations with these young men who've had to stand by and watch their child killed, and they have no legal recourse.
What advice do you give them when they're in a situation, you know, maybe they're not even involved in an abortion situation, yeah, but that's just their position, and they're immediately shut down or screamed down by the radical females on the other side of this issue?
Well, it's funny, you know, arguments don't have gender, people do, and there are two. I say that a lot on campuses. That makes them, then that gets them really mad, right? That there's only two genders. It's completely insane to say that a person who is a male can't make a moral argument, right? That doesn't make any logical sense. Are there any other social injustices, human rights injustices, where you would say only one gender can have a say in this? And the funny thing is, too, is look at the other side. They are more than happy to have pro-choice men, the bro-choicers, right? They welcome them at their rallies. They cheer them on when they come and hold their keep abortion legal signs. But yet, it's only the pro-life men that ever get yelled at. And so, you know, if they really want to be consistent with their opinion, then they should tell all these pro-choice male politicians in Washington, D.C. to shut up. But they don't, because they want them. And so if you're pro-choice and you're a man, it's accepted. But if you're pro-life, you're not. And so that is why the pro-life men must speak up. They must have courage. They must know we've got their backs. The ladies got their backs, right? But we've got to encourage them to speak up, because men naturally want to protect their offspring. They want to protect their children. It's you know, when you think about the broader culture and the challenges we have with Gen Z and even Gen Y men, you have this emasculation of men that's been going on for 50 years. And I would argue the key part of that has been abortion. We started telling men they don't have a say, that they can't even protect their own children. Think about what that's done to this whole generation of men.
Well, and it goes well beyond this issue, because, I mean, I saw a study recently where a lengthy study that was done of sexual predators and people like that, and they said the number one deterrent to targeting any female
is
a dad involved.
Oh, yeah, dad with a shotgun, I would say. yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, and the powerful, think about even a couple years ago, Bishop Cousins was presenting at a Lagos chapter meeting I was at, and he was talking about a study that the USCCB had done about, you know, keeping young people in their faith and how do we keep young people going to mass, right? I went home and immediately started lecturing my husband, because it was 90%. If you want to find out if your child's going to continue in their faith, look at what the dad does. It's not the mother's behavior. It's the dad's behavior. You know, if your husband is going to church, going to mass, participating, you've got a much better chance that your children are going to stay active in their faith after they leave the nest, right? But if the husband is not involved, it significantly affects whether or not your child will stay active in their faith.
So if you have inspired anybody listening to us today and they want to get involved in Students mm-hmm. for Life or help you out, what can they do?
Go to studentsforlife.org and you can sign up for our action alerts there. And we want to get you involved. No matter your age, there is a place for you in the pro-life movement. Your expertise, your experience, your story, we can get you involved. You can go to a website called prolifegen.org, and that's a very simple way where there's six different ways you can volunteer with the pro-life movement. I'd love to get more people involved.
And I know you've really made the ultimate sacrifice today, and you put the headphones on and messed up your hair.
I did. I'm going to go back and fix my hair. The Florida weather is not great. Now, I was complaining to one of the Lagoa staffers. I was like, I can't wait to be back in California next year because I'm just so glad this wasn't on video.
God bless you. Thanks so much for all that you do. Kristen Hawkins, president of Students for Life here at the 2025 Legatus Summit. And now if I can get the attention of our next distinguished guest. Everybody is trying to get so much done. Throw those headphones on there.
Get the attention.
We are pleased, delighted now to be joined here for the remainder of the program. President of
the National
Eucharistic Congress, Mr. Jason Shanks, who was largely responsible for the execution of the Eucharistic Revival that was called for by the bishops and the National Eucharistic Congress in particular, but took place in Indianapolis, Indiana. Your title then was...
So I was president then, too.
Oh, okay. Yes. All right. Yeah. So it's just...
And largely is very exaggerated because there were so many great people behind
the
scenes.
You had an army.
And Tim Gokowski as the CEO.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So we were really grateful. Things are going well and moving along.
That was an amazing event. I mean, and you and I have talked about this. I was abundantly skeptical. I mean, the scope of what was being proposed was beyond
huge.
What I could imagine you pulling off.
Yeah.
Were you surprised that you pulled it off at all?
I was surprised, yeah. I think the Holy Spirit really came through and delivered. Matter of fact, afterwards I told Bishop Cousins, who's the chair of the board, the Holy Spirit must have showed up because this was held together with duct tape and paper clips. and so there was such a huge event and huge endeavor. And then you throw on that, you know, let's not just do one pilgrimage across the country. Let's do four. Any one of those would have been historic and game-changing. And the team pulled it off and did it all within the matter of months. And so it's great. I mean, even though we're looking forward, you're going to have, say, 4 or 5 years to plan the next one. This was all done in the matter of two, right? So the undertaking was large, but I think it was the magnitude, the historic nature of it. People were ripe and ready that sort of led to the success of it, actually.
Give us a little bit of your background and how you found yourself steering this massive yacht.
Yeah, so I'm a convert to the Catholic faith, first and foremost, and my conversion really was because of the Eucharist, right? So I read John chapter 6, realized that, oh my gosh, he's really saying you must eat my flesh and drink my blood, right? And knew I had to become Catholic. And from there, God has just led me on a really interesting journey where I worked in a parish, I've worked at a diocese, I've ran a Catholic Charities, and I started doing a lot of different things in the startup innovation sort of space, right? How do we bring sort of new ideas, new methods and strategies for evangelization to life? And then ultimately, I must just say, I got very sick during COVID. And through that sickness and that sedation and waking up, really was taking from this intellectual conversion to the Eucharist to one of maybe a heart conversion to the Eucharist, by which when I woke up and couldn't walk and talk and eat, I realized that's Jesus in the tabernacle. And when I was invited then through our Sunday visitor to be a part of the National Eucharistic Revival Executive Team, how could I not but say yes? And then when they wanted to start in the National Eucharistic Congress, because of all this sort of other organizational leadership and background, they invited me to be on the board, in which I helped serve in treasurer. And then you know, jumped in last year to help with operation and logistics with the team, with Tim and others. And then finally, as we looked at how do we make this revival into a movement? How do we go beyond the Congress? How do we keep the revival going? I mean, I would imagine your listeners would be like, it's a 3-year revival all centered around Jesus and the Eucharist. Why would you stop? Exactly. Why would we stop? And so my goal and task is to take the revival forward. We're going to do a pilgrimage next year from L.A. I mean, rather, from Indy to L.A. We're going to do a mass and procession in L.A. We're looking ahead to incubating regional congresses around the country and looking to the next National Eucharistic Congress down the road.
What are some of the stories that you've heard from Indy of the impact that this has had on the lives of the people that were there?
Yeah, I can tell you one that really is like, so in Indianapolis, right across the convention center is this beautiful church, which we use as our perpetual adoration chapel during the Congress. Their OCIA numbers, you know, we used to call it in the old days RCIA, you know, coming into the church at Easter, has doubled. They went from like, say, 12 to 15 to over 54 people. You hear that all around Indianapolis. I think there is this misperception, in large part, that the Congress was for the choir. Right, the Congress was just for the faithful. You had quite a bit of conversions of people becoming Catholic, and the numbers are Indy are bearing those out. We're starting to see the sort of the fruit of that.
Have you ever seen anything personally quite like that Eucharistic procession through the streets of Indianapolis?
No, I've never seen anything like it. And the funny story is, for those who were there or those watching on YouTube, you have to go up a bunch of stairs to go up to where we took the monstrance, right? And Bishop Cousins, as he's gone, walked a mile, he turns the corner. We failed to tell him he's got to carry the monstrance up those stairs. And it was glorious. He went up. The bishops went up. It was a perfect setting with perfect weather, and just proclaiming our love for Jesus to the world. And he, of course, he said a very beautiful prayer up there. So it was fantastic, and we're hoping to duplicate that somewhat in L.A. So if anybody's around that area around Corpus Christi Sunday, that's when we will be doing a mass and a procession in Los Angeles, which we're excited to do.
So when will this kick off? Has the procession kicked off yet, or when will it kick off?
No, the pilgrimage kicks off in Pentecost weekend from Indianapolis, from St. John's, and then we will walk sort of through Peoria down to Dallas-Fort Worth area, and then from there we're going to go over to Oklahoma City and then up through San Diego and over to L.A. It's 3,400 miles, 20 dioceses, 4 eparchies, in like 35 days, right? So it's quite an undertaking. We realized last year with the four routes, it was the longest walk with Jesus since the apostles.
Wow.
And I said, that can't be right. And so historians and some people researched and said, yeah, it might be right. Because, you know, at one point you couldn't take Jesus out of the city because of bandits or security purposes. So what we did last year was historic. And we're making our way back to L.A. and continue to look. We wanted to do that every year. But what I'm really grateful by is you see New Hampshire's going to have a pilgrimage. The Camino, the missions in California are starting to connect together for pilgrimage. And with the Year of Jubilee, the Pilgrimage of Hope, you see dioceses all across the country creating sort of local pilgrimages. So we are a people of on pilgrimage, and there's nothing... there's some really spiritual fruits from doing it, and I'm excited that not only what we're doing, it's starting to take off around the country.
You know, I'm a convert as well,
yeah.
and at the parish in the Des Moines, Iowa area,
yeah.
where I was when I went through RCIA, we had an old Monsignor who was in residence there,
yes.
very old, could barely see.
Yeah.
Had his homilies were printed out like 8 words to a page.
Right.
I mean, he could barely see anymore. But he used to tell the story about growing up in Cleveland,
yeah.
and that 8 brothers and sisters, mom would get them all bundled up in the winter
yes.
to walk 2 blocks up to the parish to go to mass on a Sunday.
Yeah, beautiful.
She'd unbundle them when they get there.
Yeah.
She'd bundle them back up. They'd row back to the house, unbundle yeah. when they get back to the house. And he said the thing that he took away from that is that this must be really important.
Really important.
And we've done a lot of stuff in this country to make it look like the Eucharist is not very important.
Yeah.
Which I think makes this initiative of the bishops
yeah.
brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I think that's why it needs to keep going, right? Like, there's a lot more work to do, and we're sort of majoring on our majors, right? We're minoring on the minors, and there's nothing more major than Jesus and the Eucharist, right? This is the centrality of our faith, And what I think is really interesting about what the revival has done is it's not like I'm a convert. When I came in, it was like, you know, you find what is truth, who's the Lord, is the Bible historically reliable? And down the road, you get to, you know, the Eucharist. We're leading with Jesus. We're leading with the Eucharist. We're putting that out there front and center, both in our processions, our pilgrimages, and even what happened at the Congress. So it's really interesting to let Jesus work on people's hearts, work on people's minds, get them a little curious, and not to be shy about who we are as Catholics. And we are Eucharistic people.
I mean, if it's not who he says it is, what's the point, right? Like the what was the shirt that Jonathan Romey had on in Indianapolis? It was a quote from Flannery O'Connor.
Flannery O'Connor, yeah. Like if this isn't the real presence,
To hell with it.
To hell with it. Yeah. Yes, yeah. That was great that he wore it. And I think that's true, right? Like, what are we talking about here? I mean, again, my conversion was John 6, of him saying, "You must eat my flesh and drink my blood," and people didn't believe him. And I thought, oh my gosh, he's going to say, no, this is symbolic. He doubles down on it. And then you get to the point where disciples leave, John 6:66. And then finally, he turns to the apostles and said, you also want to go. This is the one that, and I was like, as a convert, I'm like, we read the Bible literally, not you Catholics. The Catholics not only read it literally, in this case, he triples down on it. And it stood out to me that said, oh my gosh, he really means it. And even the apostles were like, we're not real sure what to do with this, but we know who you are. We're going to take this on faith. And it probably wasn't until the Last Supper that they sort of clicked. So it is who we are, and he loves us to the very end, and the very end meaning he's willing to take on and become, take on the form, if you will, I guess, of bread and wine.
Greatest act of humility in the history. Mankind, for sure.
So
we talk about the great transformations and conversions that people had at the event in Indianapolis.
Right.
You had that happening throughout the pilgrimage trails, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh my gosh, the pilgrimage, it was so powerful. I was so blessed. I went to San Francisco, and with my daughter, I walked over the San Francisco Bridge. And I had thought that might have been done before, and it had never been done before.
Wow.
And so we went over the Golden Gate Bridge. And I remember then I stayed around for the next day or two. And as we're doing it, you would like turn corners and there'd be massive crowds. And I remember texting the team and I said,
San Francisco.
Yeah. Is it possible that revival was here? Because you just saw from the media and others, secular outlets and the like, this was really resonating. That Jesus is on the move. He's here to heal. And it was really interesting because this was during a political season, and we did it very carefully because this wasn't about politics. This was for us about an encounter with Christ and people after people. And it was nice, too, because not everybody could participate in the Congress, but they could participate locally as it was coming through. And I'm hopeful we're going to see that again. We have one diocese, which I've been told is even written a helicopter this time to take Jesus up to bless his whole diocese. Isn't that incredible? So the boldness of the bishops during this pilgrimage has been inspiring.
So how can people kind of keep abreast of where the revival goes from here?
Yeah, so you can go to our website, eucharisticcongress.org. You can sign up for our Heart of the Revival newsletter. Also, all the Congress content on our end is on Mana app. So if you want to download on Apple or Google, we do have an app that has talks, breakout sessions, on a variety of other content from the Congress. And we're going to continue to be posting updates and, of course, how people can get involved in the upcoming pilgrimage and activities in L.A. We're also going to be forming Eucharistic missionaries to become revivalists, if you will, and asking for people to be sort of commissioned as such around the country on Corpus Christi this year.
Awesome. Jason, thanks. Shanks, rather. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Shanks and thanks. That makes it difficult on a radio guy.
Yeah, Shanks be to God.
There you go. So that's Jason Shanks, the president of the National Eucharistic Congress from the 2025 Legatus Summit here in beautiful Naples, Florida.